Reveal, I am a patent attorney, so I wanted to bring that to light. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to talk to you then.
Dr. Gerhardt, would you proceed?
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm delighted to tell you about stem cell research. I lead at Hopkins the stem cell program, which cuts across many departments, many institutes. We deal with adult sources, umbilical sources, placental sources, embryonic sources, and tumor sources. So we are, I think, poised to address many of the issues in stem cell biology. Very little of this, although we have a clinical trial now starting with mesenchymal stem cells for heart, most of it's preclinical and experimental, and this is where it belongs. One of our problems is every time we talk about this topic, we get hundreds, if not thousands, of requests for stem cells or organs, et cetera. It's going to be a while. I can skip over probably much of what I have on these cartoons that you have, but I want to make a few points. First, to make it clear in your minds what a stem cell is and how unique it is, some of which we have in our adult bodies, many more of which we have when we were embryos or fetuses. And so a stem cell, unlike most of your body cells, has a capacity to self-renew, which means it can produce another cell like itself. And it has the ability to specialize into something. Now, some stem cells in our bodies can only divide once. Some stem cells can only produce one cell type. Others can divide many times and produce many different cell types. And this is really where the science is, trying to figure out, among all these different stem cell sources, what cells have the capacity for generating what kinds of tissues. We have a vested interest in embryonic stem cells, but it's not that we are blinded to anything else. We are comparing in the laboratory, side by side, stem cell sources from all tissues. This is the only way we're going to find out what works and what doesn't work. If you have a stem cell source, there are certain criteria you have and you have to meet. And I've listed these on this particular image, dealing with, they can renew, they're stable, you can expand them to the numbers you'd need for any kind of a therapy. With the specialization, you want to make sure you can reproduce this time and time again, quality control issues, that you can control it, and that the output that you get results in an authentic, functional cell like the one that's present in your body or that you've lost. And this is where the research is. All of these elements on any stem cell population, and this is where the arguments you see among stem cell investigators as to what capacity any stem cell has in this arena. So, these are the various quick sources, another cartoon showing very early embryos, fetal tissue, and adult. And we get stem cells from all of these sources. Let's comment for a few minutes on the adult sources, for whether they're brain, heart, skeletal muscle, bone marrow. And I've listed them here for you. By far, the only clinical utilization and major clinical utilization, as has been described, in clinical use has been bone marrow stem cells. And there's two different populations of stem cells in bone marrow. One is blood that reproduces your blood every so many days. The other is this population that comes from the cells that we originally thought were just supporting the blood stem cells. But it turns out that these cells, which have this name mesenchymal, have the capacity to form a variety of cell types as well. So when you are putting a bone marrow graft into someone, you're actually putting blood stem cells and these other type of stem cells that in the circulation, as Dr. Friedman mentioned, can go everywhere and contribute to a variety of tissues. The issue is, are they functional in the tissues that they contribute to? You may see them there, but are they functioning? And in some cases, the answer is yes. In many cases, the answer is no. They are just residing there. We'll get into that in a moment. Neural stem cells, we thought the human brain, you know, like most of us, that we were born with a number of cells that we were ever going to have, and then from then in it was all downhill. And it still is, it seems. But the fact is, the brain does have stem cells, but to recognize them, you've got to take them out of the brain. That's kind of a bummer. I mean, the issue is, you know, when we need them now, and you recognize them by taking them out, placing them in a dish, and they begin to grow into different neurons and things like this. You can then graft those cells back in. But the important thing is they don't produce all the different types of neuronal and cell types present in your brain. They will only produce the ones from the region in which you took it out. Quite limited. Or the spinal cord. Okay?
Doctor, let me stop you for a second. You mentioned, and Dr. Friedman mentioned about the migration. You said that some of these cells apparently reside.
Right.
I'm thinking of a telescope, Mount Palomar. If somebody said, we only see these stars and that's all that's there,
right.
Then we had radio telescopes which went beyond it. Is it that they're residing and we don't have any equipment to understand what they're doing, or by any conventional marker that we've used, they're not producing the same activity that that cluster of cells in the brain or the heart or the liver
right.
is doing?
It's all of the above, the sensitivity of the assays we have, and it's, you know, where you're looking and how you're looking. And once we were aware that these cells could go everywhere, we began to look everywhere, which means that you're serially sectioning every animal that you're, I mean, every tissue, and you have markers for grafted cells versus the host cells. So, but then the issue comes, when you find these cells, are they functional? Clearly, as pointed out in one of Dr. Friedman's slides, you do see a good contribution to hepatocytes, the liver, and they are functional. But many times, the cells within the brain that you see from these grafts do not produce functional neurons. They will actually sit next to other neurons or fuse with an existing neuron. And if you have a marker for that grafted cell and it fuses with a host cell, you come away thinking that's your grafted cell. But it has actually fused. Two cells have come together, their membranes have been dissolved, and they've fused into one. And we see this time and time again in these kinds of grafts. So it's an issue of how functional you find these cells throughout. Cardiac stem cells, within the last few years, it's apparent that our hearts that have showed no regenerative capability has a stem cell population. And now we're investigating how robust is it? And why don't these stem cells work in vivo? I mean, you get an injury and whatnot. Why can't we, so we're undertaking experiments to try to stimulate them in the tissues to see if we can get them to function. We've talked about umbilical cord blood and placenta, which contain the same kinds of populations that bone marrow does, only they're probably more robust. There was an image of a quote from Catherine Verfey, who one of the premier investigators on stem cell, non-embryonic stem cells from bone marrow, saying that these cells can produce all cell types that embryonic stem cells can. The frequency with which they do this is abysmal. And there's an issue of whether these cells are actually functional. So there is an issue that I would like to argue that embryonic stem cells have a unique role if we can really show that they're safe.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a question?
Yes.
On that? Can you comment, Doctor, on the recent study published by Dr. Huard at the Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh? Yeah, just published in July, Molecular Cell Biology, right?
Right, and you're talking now about muscle satellite cells having greater capacity than just skeletal muscle?
Well, specifically, he was talking about demonstrating the ability to not only that the adult stem cells had were pluripotent, but that they were able to multiply with the same capacity as embryonic stem cells, and that, of course, was the problem that we're trying to overcome with the study you just mentioned. And
right.
He claims to have done that, and this paper is presumably up for paper of the year now because this study has come out.
Well, look.
I'm just want you to, if you
no,
can.
No, I'm happy to.
Thank you.
I know Johnny well. That's not I know the studies.
Good, thank you.
There is no question that there are adult stem cells that we will be able to use I mean, that have these properties that we want and that we'll be able to use in some type of therapies. And the trick may be trying to figure out how you do grow them and how you do induce them to divide. The issue of pluripotency, which is a fancy term we use to say how many different cell types can that form, I think in some of his experiments are problematic. Okay? That doesn't mean it shouldn't be published and shouldn't be out there. Let's see if it's reproducible, et cetera. So the paper just came out, and we'll see. In science, we've got to reproduce, and we'll see, well, I mean, we've got to reproduce results. Okay. Okay. These are just two headlines from papers a few years ago showing that when bone marrow is grafted in, it fuses with cells. They don't form hepatocytes themselves, although we do know that it's capable of that, but they fuse and they appear to form hepatocytes because of that, et cetera. In all stem cell biology at this point, when you see research papers, and I am an editor of Science and review a lot of things, even as a professional, it sometimes gets very difficult to ferret out what is fact and what is interpretation. And that doesn't mean that something isn't reality. So I'm just, you know, cautioning you when you see these reports and papers and things, you just got to, you know, be a little careful and ask someone who's perhaps a little bit more knowledgeable, but what's that saying, really? What is the data saying on this? And I'm just, that's a word of caution. And it's hard for the public to understand this. You see so many of these banner headlines, very difficult. I got to put a plug in for embryonic stem cells, okay? These are derived from these very early staged embryos. In the process, that embryo is destroyed. And this work goes back, originally discovered in mice in the 1980s, and the first person to do this in humans was Jamie Thompson, followed by a number of other investigators, such that today in the world, there are probably well over 250 lines of human embryonic stem cells, validated lines. Okay? 22 of them appear on the president's list. When this was published, it became, you know, the event of the year in science, et cetera, because of the potential here. Why? Because with human embryonic stem cells, the two properties that they have is that they can divide indefinitely and they can produce every cell type that's present in the body.
Dr. Waite, we are somewhat like Will Rogers, all we know is what we read in the paper. But so then it is not accurate to say that there's only, I mean, the 22 lines were ones that the president said you could use, but there's at least 260 other cell lines derived from embryos that are out there now that researchers are already doing in private research and stuff.
Right, around the world.
Okay.
Yeah, and yeah. We'll get to that.
How many of these are in the United States?
In use in the United States?
Yes, in research.
Well, with Doug Melton's lines coming from Harvard, which were 17, many of those are being used. Certainly a few, I'd say probably a dozen or more of the ones that are on the presidential lists are routinely used at this point. Most of the lines exist outside the country.
So there's up to 50 lines or 35 lines in the United States? Or?
Oh, no. I mean, I don't know how many are actually being used in labs because if it's private money, they can work on any numbers. I'm trying to tell you about the people that we sort of run with, what lines we use, and there's a sort of a standard set that we...
I mean, the reason I'm asking that question is I see the reasons for voting for some of these bills in Congress are that they say we only have these small number of lines and therefore we need more, so I don't know if that rationale is accurate given what you're saying here now.
Well, on federal funds. It's only federal funds on those 22 lines. The other ones don't have federal funds, and we'll get to that towards the end. Here's the most difficult aspect of this work at this point in time. We have these embryonic stem cells in a dish. They are capable of forming all of these cell types, 200 and some present in the human body. How do we get them only to form a single one of these? How do we direct them to form what we want, whether we want cardiomyocytes, insulin-producing cells, dopaminergic neurons for Parkinson's patients? That is the difficulty. I want to remind you, by down in the corner of this, I've entered some pictures of germ cells, just to let you know that these cells in a dish can also form what looks like eggs and what looks like sperm. We're going to take all the fun out of reproduction. I mean, it's in a dish. We can do that, which tells you these cells are a really very special kind of cells. But the real difficulty in science right now is growing up, as Dr. Friedman mentioned, the hundreds of thousands of millions of cardiomyocytes or whatever you want to do a graft with and make sure they're only those cells. That's difficult.
Delegate, Senator Sessler.
Now these, in the first meeting, whoever was, I don't remember who the speaker was, but he said that this has to be done in 5 days, harvested in 5 days.
I bailed.
Oh, I mean the original source of the cells, the IVF embryos that are taken to derive the stem cells, they're taken sometime in the first week following fertilization of the egg, if that's the question you're asking.
The egg is, all right, what does that look like under a microscope at that point? What are we looking
at? Hang on a minute.
He's got it in here.
Have that for you. It's on one of your diagrams further down. But it's important because we can talk about it. No, I haven't. What I want to show you were the real things so that we can talk about kind of slow here on this computer. It's one of the images on page, where we can just go to page 8 at the top right-hand side. These are the earliest stages. The images at the top are unfertilized human eggs. The second row is when fertilization is affected and what we call cleavage begins, which means that cell division is occurring. And then...
Excuse me, this is a cartoon. Do you mean page 7, Dr. Gerhardt?
No, I was on page 8. It's this image here that I'm trying to show.
On page 8, it's the trick will be to separate the nuclei, religion and politics.
Uh-oh. Not what we want.
At least on the printout.
It's bottom left on 7.
Bottom left on 7?
Anyway, it's this image here that's in front, that's up above you. I'm having some.
Which is what we're looking at?
What we...
Which one?
What we are looking at, let me see if I can pull this thing up. It's taking a long time for this computer. We're looking at the bottom row. It's on your image now.
Look at the bottom row.
The bottom row. What we're starting with is an unfertilized human egg. We go through fertilization. These periods take 36, 48 hours, and then we begin these divisions. It's a ball, a cluster of cells, and then it cavitates. And you can begin to see that cavitation in the bottom row. That structure in the bottom row is called a blastocyst. That's our term for this. This is the structure that is reached when this fertilized embryo comes down the oviducts into the uterus and implants into the uterine wall and a pregnancy is established.
So this is before implantation?
This is before implantation.
So it can be 7 to 10 days after fertilization?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. And in...
How many cells would that be, number of ways?
It varies anywhere from approximately 60 up to several hundred at this point. But it contains two cell populations. And you can see this in the bottom panel. There's like a ring of cells around the outside. Those cells are destined to become placental tissues. That's what touches the endometrium and invades into the endometrium. In panel B at the bottom, you see a little cluster of cells sticking out. That is what we refer to as the inner cell mass, and those are, and there may be only 20 of those cells present. The rest are in the outside. It's those cells which give rise to the embryo proper. And eventually they become connected to the outside layer through the umbilical cord. Okay?
Senator.
And how big is that?
It is just visible to the naked eye, about 100 microns in diameter.
Well, it was smaller than the dot of an eye in a newspaper.
Depending on your font, Senator, yes. No, but you're right. It's much smaller than that. It's just visible to the naked human eye.
So really, it doesn't contain anything other than a potential for life. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. That's correct.
All right.
Yeah, and that potential can only be realized if it implants in the uterine wall.
Yeah.
Okay. Now.
Well, it's growing.
I said, I'm going to fail me.
Yes, doctor.
I just want to correct one little thing. That inner cell mass, the 20-cell mass, it does form the embryo proper, but it also forms some extra embryonic tissue in addition, the amnion, the chorion. So it's not exclusively embryo. There's still some division and some change that has to take place. So when we talk 20 cells, only a portion of that still will form the baby proper.
And it's believed that that number may be as small as 3 of that of those. So it's those 20 cells that are taken out to put in culture to derive embryonic stem cells. But in the process, you destroy that structure. Okay? This is the strategy. Very sorry. This is the strategy we use, or what we base our strategy on. Sorry. For getting the cell types we want, and if I do that one more time, I'm leaving the room. Sorry. The issue is, how do you get a cell that can form every cell type in the body to form the one you want? This is what we use. The fate of a cell in a human embryo, developmental fate as to what it becomes, is dependent upon where it is in that embryo. And where it is specified by the cells that are around it, secreting different kinds of factors in a changing manner as development proceeds, and we try to mimic this in a dish through our knowledge of molecular biology. So we add and subtract different kinds of growth factors as we're going along to get it to the point we want. Our success in any given cell type is dependent upon our knowledge base in mammalian embryology as to what it takes to get a cardiomyocyte, or to get a motor neuron, or to get an insulin-producing cell. So in some of these cases, we're quite successful. We can grow millions and millions of motor neurons. We know more about how that's formed than we do about an islet cell producing insulin, or a variety of other cell types. So this is basically the kind of what we use. What are we doing currently? We're growing up these various cell types individually, or with the biomedical engineers, we are constructing what we call organoids, parts of organs, and grafting them into various kinds of animals, or animal models, either disease models or injury models, and to see if they'll function. The applications for human ES work, we feel, are listed here. We don't have to go into detail because some of it is a dream at this point. But clearly, the fundamental discovery issue is important. We think we're going to do cell-based therapies out of this. We're going to study human diseases. It's going to be important in drug development. Whether we can grow organs or not is a different issue. Several years ago, when we did our first grafting from human cells, we derived neural stem cells. And we used a rat model for a motor neuron loss, such that when we destroyed the motor neurons in these animals, they were paralyzed for life. Their lower motor neurons were destroyed. We then infused into the cerebral spinal fluid of these animals neural stem cells derived from the embryonic stem cell. Okay? And every animal in which we did this with obtained locomotive activity. No other cell type yet, except a mouse embryonic stem cell derived neural has done this.
Wait, stop. You use mouse embryo to inject into a mouse, or human embryo to inject into a mouse?
Human embryonic stem cell-derived neural stem cells.
Okay.
And the only equivalent cell that we could find would do the same thing, even with adult sources in this, was to go to the mouse species and derive a neural stem cell from the embryonic source.
But earlier you kind of dismissed some of what Dr. Friedman was talking about, say, hey, these mice, you know,
right,
they're not the best things to experiment in.
Yeah, they're not. Trust me. But the issue is we did it just because we had that cell source available.
Okay.
That's all. And we didn't see, I don't know if we saw tumors in these or not, but the fact, all I was getting at is what one of the things we're finding when we're comparing adult sources versus embryonic stem cell sources within the same animal models, that for not all, but many of the examples that I can show you, we're finding that the embryonic sources are performing better. That's all I'm telling you.
Better than
the adult source, or if the adult source works at all, which we're finding in ALS models doesn't work well at all. The embryonic sources work much better, for example. This is the only way we can end these, you know, this controversy as to which of these sources are going to work.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Dr. Hallowell.
Can you please then address the adult stem cells that have been touted as being used, I believe, out of Dr. Carlos Lima in Portugal has been treating over 35.
Around the neurons that are obtained from the nasal neurons. I mean, this is it works. We haven't used that particular model with embryonic stem cells. I'm not here to say that adult stem cells will not, you know, will never be used. We have picked certain high visibility targets, whether it's ALS, Parkinson's, diabetes, things like that. We're comparing. We're not doing it across the board. So again, I want to emphasize this is model specific.
Okay, I'm just trying to appreciate the distinction and advantage that you're trying to demonstrate or to us using the embryonic stem cells. That's what I'm trying to appreciate.
Here's an example in front of you.
Okay.
This green blob. Okay. To us, it's exciting because what this is. These are human motor neurons grown from human embryonic stem cells. We can grow these absolutely pure populations of motor neurons, and we can grow them in large numbers. There's no adult source of a neural stem cell that will do this. None. We can also grow out of this large numbers of the glia, the cells that are associated with it. Even neural stem cells, we have in Baltimore, Mahindra Rao, who was the one who established all the adult sources of glial stem cells. They don't match what we can do with the embryonic sources. But these are examples. I'm not saying that there are others that won't, you know, the other thing won't hold. So,
Doctor, you don't have to apologize. We picked you precisely because you're an advocate for the embryo stem cells, and the charge of our committee is to look at all of these, the efficacy of them, and we've got experts over here to discuss the ethics of this as well.
Okay.
So,
here's another example. Yeah. This is human embryonic, these cardiac cells are derived from human embryonic stem cells. And we've been able to grow large quantities of this, and we can show physiologically by any measure you want that these are functional, normal cardiomyocytes. We can grow them in large numbers. And we have begun grafts. Now this is much like Dr. Friedman had mentioned, using mesenchymal stem cells, for example. Here we're placing human embryonic stem cells into a mouse heart. And these dark cells, they're labeled, this is a human component of the wall of the heart of that mouse. Output has increased. We do a number of measurements on these hearts. We've now moved this into pigs, which are more amenable to these kinds of things. And we're very happy about this outcome. Now, will cardiac stem cells from the adult heart work? Those are experiments are now being done with those, not clinical trials. These are cardiac cells from adults. So we're very pleased with this. And I could go on to show you some of our work done with insulin-producing cells, et cetera, from embryonic stem cells.
Dr. Gerhard, have you continued these experiments with these mice to the stage where the other researchers found teratomas when they used direct embryo cells as opposed to derived embryo cells? In other words, have you gone the same length of time, and what's the result?
No, we have not. Most of these animals are put down within a month to 6 weeks. That's certainly not enough time. If you had one embryonic stem cell in there that could give rise to a tumor, no question.
Or even a derived cell.
I'm talking about, I mean, if they have that capacity.
Okay.
Where we have looked over time is that we have engrafted into monkeys, into monkey spinal cords, motor neurons derived from the embryonic stem cells, also dopaminergic neurons into monkey models of Parkinson's disease, which we have looked at about 4 years out and have not seen a tumor.
You said the problem that you have is to ensure that the cell develops in a certain way. Do you mean that when you want to develop regenerative cells for a Parkinson's patient, that you'll develop nerve cells and not liver cells or pancreas cells or some other kind of cells?
Exactly.
And right now you don't know which one of these little markers you're picking that develops on down the road.
Oh, absolutely. We do. I mean, we are doing a lot of genomic and proteomic studies on these pathways that we can pick out immediately what cells are going into what lineages. So we are we're very concerned about any kind of graft being a mixture of cells, and we're doing our best to get it to homogeneity as early as possible. And in some cases, I think we're being quite successful. I've listed on two slides here that you can read later where we are in our research emphasis in embryonic stem cell work. Some of it is very similar to the adult. And the issues of safety that Dr. Friedman brought up is a major concern. It's not only tumors. We know that cells can migrate away and wrap themselves around a blood vessel in the brain and stroke an animal out. I mean, we're very concerned about keeping cells where we place them. I mean, so that...
Dr. Fisher has a question, I think.
I want to ask the proverbial dumb question. Going back, you mentioned all the stem cell lines. What does that mean? Is that a differentiated, targeted type? Or how does that play into the to the particular target?
Right. What these... a couple hundred or more stem cell lines means that these are maintained as embryonic stem cells.
Okay.
They are undifferentiated, unspecialized. They are the stem cells with the capacity, when you culture them under appropriate conditions, to specialize into whatever you want.
What makes them a separate line from another line?
They were, as Dr. Friedman, they came from a single blastocyst.
Oh, okay.
And some of them, we probably believe, could have gotten two lines out of a single blastocyst, but most of them are separate origin.
So it started with only 22 blastocysts for the president's line, then?
That's correct.
I see.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
I wanted to comment on this topic, not cloning of dogs. It seems every time you pick up in the papers, another animal has been added to Noah's Ark of clones. But how this plays into embryonic stem cell research? This is a hot button topic, this is what our lab looked like before we got money to go forward. All right. The issue is you're all familiar with this guy and this sheep. Okay. This was the first example of an animal born from the nucleus of an adult cell transferred into a nucleated egg. We all know that there should be many more wolves on this page, okay, and it's something which should not be permitted, and a bill was introduced in the U.S. Senate just before they went for a break to ban what's called reproductive cloning. And no scientist would argue that we should be able to do this. I mean, so we want to get that off the table. We're not targeting to clone human beings for the reasons that are obvious, okay? There are a lot of problems with the animals that are generated. It's this that we're interested in this diagram, and Dr. Friedman mentioned it. We began using the term therapeutic cloning, and we regret it in 1999 when we were doing this. The idea is to match an embryonic stem cell line with a patient. And you do this by taking a cell from a patient, taking the nucleus of that cell, introducing it into a nucleated human egg, and generating a blastocyst and then embryonic stem cells from that blastocyst that genetically, as far as the nucleus is concerned, matches the patient. And this, again, what Dr. Friedman mentioned, Koreans a year ago first showed you can do this in humans, and then recently they did this from 9 spinal cord injury patients, one with an immune deficiency and one with juvenile diabetes. So now there are stem cell lines that match those patients, if only they could figure out how to get the cell types they want out to give to the patients. But this is the idea. You can overcome the immune response for this, and there's a few other reasons why we want to be able to do it. It's a very powerful technology. But we are generating an embryo to get the stem cells. Okay, that's where the issue is. Does it work? There are now several examples in the mouse and one in cattle in which a clone embryo has generated a stem cell line that has been used to correct a deficiency or a deficit in an animal, in the animal from which they've taken the cell. So I think we're going to argue that it works, at least from the experimental side. What else do we want to do with it? Last year, in spring this year, the United Kingdom awarded the first license to the person that made Dolly, the sheep, to clone embryos from ALS patients. And this is what they're doing. They're taking samples, skin samples, taking the nuclei, generating the lines. Why? We want to study the pathogenesis of ALS. And we can do it in a dish. You have a complete clinical record of that patient, and now you have the cells in the dish. You can look for therapies, you can do a lot of things with those cells, and it's a very, very powerful technology. Again, coming back to what Dr. Friedman mentioned, it's going to be years before any of this is in a clinic. And many of the reasons deal not with our inability or our capabilities of differentiating these cells into things, but safety issues. What we have to demonstrate to the FDA to get approval to go to a clinical trial. Not just contaminating them with another cell type, but many of the things we've already talked about. And this is part and parcel to every experiment we do. When I went before the FDA committee, pounding my chest how wonderful we are with all these results, they didn't care anything about how well this was working. They said, well, Dr. Gerhardt, you're putting in 300,000 cells into this animal. We want to know where every cell went. Can't do it, but you can approach it. So every experiment we do, we have labeled cells that we can use MRI, micro-PET, markers for histology, things that we can tell where those cells went and whether they're functioning. But this is where we are. This is the state of where we are. I think, obviously, we have people who can talk more to this than I can on the ethic issues, so I'm going to skip this. But I want to come to one thing at the... I think you'll talk about that. There are many more ethical issues than just the sources of stem cells, and I think Jonathan will talk about some of these things, which are very, very critical. And let's address this issue. President Bush did have a difficult situation on his hands when he had to come up with a policy statement, and it was a can of worms. And what he said was he was going to permit or make eligible for federal funding stem cell lines that were in existence before 9 p.m. August 9th, 2001. There were 70-some lines on that list, at least reported. they're now down, I mean, and we recognize that these really weren't lines, most of them, they're down to 22. Okay, and that's where we are in cell lines eligible for federal funding. This has hampered severely the research in this country, and there's no question about it. And we may get into some of this, but I'll tell you, on the front lines of this, it has in many, many different ways. There's a bill that was passed by the House of Representatives in Washington. It's now being considered by the Senate. And as you are all aware, we had a very important change of mind. Very critical. And we hope that this goes on, although we have no assurance that the President would sign the bill if it reached his desk. In fact, he says he wouldn't. But I think we're making inroads of trying to convince our leaders that we have to extend the policy. I don't know if someone, I think Dr. Hurlbut, if he was here, would talk about this. I don't think we have time. These are the alternatives that have been put forward as ways of generating embryonic stem cells without destroying the embryo. If we could do it, that would be wonderful. What I would tell you at this point, one of these proof of concept has been demonstrated. Embryo biopsy, where you take a single cell off of an embryo, the frequency of generating a stem cell line out of this is 1 or 2%. And no IRB in this country would permit you to sample 100 human embryos to generate a single cell line. And we can talk about some of these other things as well. Finally, I want to tell you where I think this field is going. We are, I think, within the next 10 to 15 years, going to have power over our cells in our bodies that you can't imagine. And it's going to come from our ability to instruct our cells to do what we want. Look, if we now have embryonic stem cells in a dish and we can learn how to instruct them to form any tissue type, any cell type, and to alter that function in some way that we want, this is the ultimate control over our cells. And I think this is where the concern should be among policymakers. Not that they're going to say you can't work in this area anymore. I think this is the natural evolution of this science. This is where it's going. And we can do it in situ, meaning buy your drugs, whatever it would take, to stimulate a cell in some fashion. That wouldn't be traceable by a screen. I'm just telling you that it could be used for good and or bad. You know, robustly, this work is going on in other countries. We won't talk about all the investment. You also know that science knows no state. And states around you are taking up these issues. Most of them are looking at the economic values, not the good for humankind from the standpoint of cures, but investment, and Maryland, Pennsylvania, et cetera, you know all these others. Something to think about. So what is the future? All I can tell you is I hope, for the sake of your investigators and your population in Virginia, that you would at least take this statement with some concern and think about it. I believe this work has to go forward. It can go forward, I think, under appropriate guidelines. And we should be working in this area robustly, not minimally. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, I thank you very much. I'd certainly be happy to answer your questions, your emails, provide you with any kind of material that would be helpful in any kind of decision you are trying to reach of what the state of Virginia will do in this area. I think it's going to be an exciting next 10 to 12 years in this area.
I just have two questions that come to mind. Do you agree with Dr. Friedman that if you did this search, you would find these results for the teratomas or the cancer?
I was surprised at the number. You said 3,000, I believe. But I would venture to say that it is probably mouse. Although you mentioned the non-human primate, I don't know if those were non-human primate ES cells that were used in those experiments. They were. I'm just surprised by the amount. I mean, So I
But you would agree that...
Ford.
Apparently he's done the search, but if
right.
you would agree then also that if you did the search with non-embryo stem cells, you would find none or an insignificant amount of teratomas or
you wouldn't find it, you don't find any teratomas, but the issue is, do you find other kinds of tumors? And I would agree with that. Most of the work in grafts have been done with hematopoietic bone marrow based things or mesenchymal cells, and to my knowledge I don't know of any reports of tumors being formed from those grafts.
When are you going to carry an experiment on long enough so that you might get to that point where these other researchers have found one in four, one in two,
right?
With these mice,
well,
or whatever.
Well, with mouse, you can do it very quickly. I mean, these tumors come up very quick in a mouse.
But you killed the mice before they got...
Oh, no, but no, I'm talking about the mouse cells in mice.
Oh.
The human, we are, as I say, we have monkeys that are now, I don't know, 5 years old or something that have these cells in it, but I think the issue here is one of numbers. And we've talked to the FDA about this and how they're going to handle this. You know, this whole stem cell therapy thing to them is a whole new ballgame. And as Dr. Friedman mentioned, they don't want another genetic-based problem here. And we've talked about a rolling mechanism of saying, well, we'll put things in non-human primates and they'll be out so many years before you would get into the humans, et cetera, things like that. But I can't stress enough the patient-based pressure that is being brought for compassionate use kinds of things, and whether or not they're even willing to wait for that length of time. That's another issue, which I think has been an interesting one.
Is the mouse used because it has a particular sensitivity or susceptibility to cancer? So presumably the researchers can say, well, maybe we shouldn't go this way, or is there a reason for the mouse?
Yeah, well, the mouse was the animal in which embryonic stem cells were first isolated, and so there's been a lot of work on differentiating, specializing, grafting in the mouse. That's all I can tell you.
Any other questions?
Yeah, yes.
Chris.
Dr. Gerhardt, could you just tell us how much time passed between the discovery of adult stem cells and their first use then in humans for treatment?
Well, I think these cells were actually being used as a treatment before it was recognized they were stem cells. And this is the hematopoietic ones. As mentioned, these grafts occurred, it wasn't until the mid-1970s that we had an idea of what hematopoietic stem cells I can't say they're isolated. There's still an argument whether anyone's isolated them yet. But we knew that bone marrow had these special properties and things like that, but it wasn't. So in that case, the use of it came before it was recognized as a stem cell population.
I've heard people say that 7 years have gone by since the time when embryonic stem cells were discovered, and so far there's been no therapeutic use of them in humans, and that seems to worry or be bothersome to some people. And so I just didn't know what the timeline was with adult stem cells.
Working with a very different type of cell when you're working with an embryonic stem cell. And I should tell you, from the time of discovery or publication in 1998 of The Human, this was only in a couple laboratories in the world. And how you would then, and they weren't easily obtained. I mean, there was a skill to developing these things, to deriving them in culture. And then the whole distribution system. If one thing that the federal government has done, I think in a right way, is that what money they've put into this, they have put it into the superstructure of getting people trained in this area. It's a whole new field. It's a very difficult cell to work with. So I imagine if we were sitting here 7 years from now, you may be asking me the same question. Why haven't we been using these in clinical trials yet? And I would say, I think we will be before that time, but we have a lot of work to do to prove the safety issues and the efficacy issues with these cells. We do.
Ms. Golden, have any more questions?
No, thank you.
Any other member? Yes, Senator.
Just a comment. I see maybe in 7 years we'll be in the ironic situation where science in the U.S. has been surpassed in other countries. Other countries have done the research we've tied our hands behind our back on, and other countries will have approved drugs that are not, or therapies that are not approved by the FDA. And then the question in 7 years or so that we'll have is, what's the ethics of depriving our own population of medicines and therapies used in the rest of the world?
Well, you could travel and get those therapies, but if Senator Brownback has his way, you will be a criminal if you go and get some of these therapies in other countries. This is part of the legislation that is being considered. But the other comment I want to make is we've already lost our lead in this area. These discoveries were made here. If you look at the number of publications, if you look at the number of patents, if you look at the types of work that is being done, you see whether it is in Australia, Singapore, Korea, Israel, UK, we can give this big list to you, and where our students are going. Until California came online, my students had already lined up postdocs and positions outside the country.
Is that, may I interject, is that private research overseas or is it funded by governments?
Much of it is funded by governments. It's also private, but when you hear of Singapore putting in $300 million into this thing or China, we have no idea. They have invested very heavily here. The Korean government is the sponsor of the work for the cloned embryo ES work, and that is millions and millions of dollars. Japan has put a lot of money in the UK. And some countries have said no. I mean, that's the other end of this too.
So that's why it would have been helpful to have the NIH here to tell us something, but they're in a cave over in Bethesda somewhere. So, all right, if there are no more questions, we will proceed. Any more questions with Dr.